So I'd like to extend a warm welcome to each one of you. It's so good to see all the familiar faces and the new faces, and you're all very welcome. And I'm happy that we're practicing and celebrating Vesak today. And Tuari, do you want to offer a few words of welcome?
I do. Sheila, I was just about to chat you. It's so good to see you. I see all these faces from people I've seen before. It's very nice that we're here. I'm so glad we're doing this early morning, in the early morning hours. So welcome, all of you, and I hope that we have a very beautiful Vesak day all day today. So we're just going to spend an hour together, but I hope our whole day goes in a very nice way.
Thank you, Tuari.
Welcome.
So just a few words kind of orienting you for the day. So I'll offer a little talk. Tuari will offer a short talk also. And then we'll do a ceremony led by Tuari with some chanting. And then have some practices for you for today, if you like to engage in a way of holding this throughout the day, both for those who have plenty of time and those who have more limited time. All right, so I'll begin with the little talk here. Tuari, I'm going to mute you just so there's less background.
I can.
Okay, thank you. So I thought I would kind of share some of the life history of the Buddha, particularly what was drawn from the early texts, the early suttas. And so some of these are a little different from what you have heard from the kind of the mythology and story around the Buddha. So it's nice to have kind of this perspective also. So the Buddha was born to a fairly wealthy family. It was even considered a prince. And this is, I'm drawing this from a book called The Life of the Buddha. And this is actually part of an article that we're putting in the Sims newsletter. And I'll share that with you at the end of this morning together as a preview for the newsletter. So the Buddha was born approximately in 563 BCE. And then he started to look for enlightenment. He became motivated to seek an end of suffering about the age of 29. And then 6 years later, he achieved that. He awoken fully. Then he was able to teach for another 30 years or so before he passed away. Now, his early years, there's this couple beautiful quotes I want to share. Thank you, Cheryl. The newsletter is going out at 9 o'clock this morning. Sorry, the chats. I have to kind of manage those as well as speak. So this is one of the early quotes that I was delicate, most delicate, supremely delicate. A white sunshade was held over me day and night so that no cold or heat or dust or grit might inconvenience you. So you can imagine having someone carrying around an umbrella to keep you from getting too hot or too cold throughout the day. And he had three palaces, one for the winter, one for the summer, one for the rains. So you can see the sense of really all the conditions were set up to be very pleasant, to be very relaxed for him. And then something shifted in his awareness. He, you know, the classic story is around the heavenly messengers, the messenger of someone who is aging, someone who is ill, and someone who was dead. And that shocked him into looking through the compliancy of his beautiful life, his life of comfort. And he thought, this is a quote, "Whilst I had such power and good fortune, yet I thought, when an untaught ordinary man who is subject to aging, subject to not safe in aging, sees another who is aged, he is shocked, humiliated, and disgusted, for he forgets that he himself is no exception." This is that heavenly messenger coming in and realizing he too is subject to aging. And so as he reflected on that, the vanity of youth entirely left him. And the same too with health and also with life itself, that these heavenly messengers gave him this deep motivation to begin his quest. One of the the lines that I particularly liked is that he started on the quest while he was still an unenlightened bodhisattva, being subject to death, to birth, aging, ailment, death, sorrow, and defilement. I sought after that which is also subject to these things. Then I thought, why, being myself subject to these things, do I also seek what's after what is subject to those things also? Suppose, seeing subject to these things, seeing danger in them, I sought after the unborn, unaging, unailing, the deathless, the sorrowless, undefined, supreme, sure release of bondage, or nibbana. It's such a beautiful quote, because he realizes that he himself is impermanent, that everything that he experiences is constantly in flux, constantly changing. And he's trying to find happiness in conditions which are also constantly changing, constantly in flux. And he just saw that there's these two variables that are, there's no way that they're going to ever come together for any lasting sense of happiness, this lasting sense of ease in his life. And that became the intention for his quest, his journey toward enlightenment. What is that? Now, he practiced in many ways early on. He practiced with two concentration meditation masters who are very well renowned, and he learned those skills so deeply that he was actually asked to join them to start to teach alongside them. But reflecting upon that, even those deep states, the states, you know, just this, you know, magnificent states of meditation, he realized those too were impermanent. He realized that this teaching does not lead to dispassion, to fading of lust, to cessation, to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment, to nibbana, but only to the base consisting of nothingness. And I was not satisfied with that teaching, so I left it to continue my search. This is this point of deep sincerity and discernment of the Buddha that, you know, from subjectively, he had arrived. He had met this, you know, attained consistently these deep states of meditation. But he realized that those two were conditioned. They're brought together by his effort, by his skill, but they weren't what he was looking for. And then he went on to practice in a much more severe way, as was common in those times, where you would starve your body, where you punish the body. And there's some very intense passages, and I'll just read one of them, particularly around how he related to his own mind. I thought, suppose with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed my mind with my mind. Then, as a strong man might seize a weaker by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed my mind with my mind. Sweat ran from my armpits while I did so. And though tireless energy was aroused in me, an unremitting mindfulness established, yet my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful effort. Right? So that sense of trying so hard, and I think those of us who have explored the edges of effort in our practice and come to that breaking point, realizing that does not go anywhere, does not lead to what we were seeking, does not lead to that peace, may lead to these mind states and these deep sense of concentration, but it leads to that brittleness of mind. He also experimented with eating very little, you know, to the point he was just a sense of skeleton. He said, my backside became like a camel's hoof. The projections on my spine stood forth like corded beads. My ribs jutted out as gaunt as the crazy rafters of an old roofless barn. If I touched my belly skin, I encountered my backbone too. And if I touched my backbone, I encountered my belly skin too, for my belly skin cleaved to my backbone. And this is if you've seen some of those images of the Buddha at this period, it's just so enmeshed. So basically on the verge of death from starvation. So you get a sense of how strongly and powerfully he practiced. He put his all into it. And he realized at one point that even though when he was really near death for this intense practice, that okay, whenever a monk or a Brahmin has felt in the past or will feel in the future or feels now painful, racking, piercing feelings due to striving, it can equal but not exceed what I'm feeling. Okay, so I've practiced as hard as anyone has ever practiced. But, this is the but, by this grueling penance, I have attained no distinction higher than the human state. I've attained no distinction higher than the human state, worthy of the nobleman's knowledge and vision. Might there be another way to enlightenment? Okay, so this is, again, this voice of wisdom coming through, that he exhausted his willpower, punishing his body, crushing his mind, and realizing this isn't working. Just like those sublime states from those two meditation masters didn't lead to what he was seeking, to the sense of deep peace, the deathless. And then he reflected at that time when he was a young child sitting with watching his father plow a field. I thought of a time when my Sankhya father was working and I was sitting in the cool shade of a rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual desire, secluded from unwholesome things that I had entered upon, and abode in that first meditation, which is accompanied by thinking and exploring, with happiness and pleasure born of seclusion. I thought, might that be the way to enlightenment? And then I followed up that memory. There came the recognition that this was the way to enlightenment. Sometimes in retreats, we have this idea we need to sit cross-legged on the floor. And, you know, sometimes that's a very supportive posture, and it's very the most conducive. I personally like it, except sometimes my body doesn't like it. My body rebels against it. And sometimes when I can talk a yogi who's really struggling, their legs are hurting, they're falling asleep, they're sitting in a chair, it's like suddenly this whole weight has been lifted off them. There's a sense of ease that suddenly their level of concentration just rises forth because they're no longer struggling with this themselves. And so that's a little taste of what the Buddha realized, that the struggle he was self-inducing upon his mind, upon his body, that was not ultimately beneficial. And when he gave himself the permission to go into this much more relaxed, natural mindfulness, this natural awareness, to actually feed himself, to nurture himself, then he was able to enter into awakening. Of course, the night of awakening, which is also part of Vesak, there's different ways there's many different parts of that aspect, which I'm not going to go into because of time. One of the images from the history, the lineage around that night of awakening is that Mara, the deity of delusion, tried to convince the Buddha not to become awakened, to get him off his seat, and threw the different armies of lust and fear at him, and they were said to be like arrows flying toward the Buddha, and they turned into flowers. Now, the final strategy of Mara was to say, you know, by what right do you have to awaken? And the Buddha reached down and touched the earth, that famous posture, and said, by the right of the earth, that I have this right to awaken, to fully release my heart. So as he awoken, the first words that came to him, maybe not the first words he spoke, but what came to him, and I shared that in the poem. Seeking but not finding the house builder, I travel through the round of countless births. Oh, painful is birth ever and again. House builder, you have now been seen. You shall not build a house again. Your rafters have been broken down. Your ridgepole is demolished too. My mind has now attained the uniformed nibbana and reached the end of every kind of craving. So the sense of the house builder, that sense of self, even more so, the house is the self and the mechanism is that house builder that's so unseen, that operates behind the scenes all the time, even as Buddha was saying, through his lifetimes of searching, that impulse, that primal delusional impulse that creates that sense of isolation, of separation. And finally, he saw that. He saw it so clearly, and just in the seeing, then everything fell away. And it's replaced, his heart awoken. Now the Buddha, after he awoken, he reflected on how hard that journey was and how hard it was to go through his normal will, that so much of us, we have to kind of learn to go through our will, to release and surrender. And he had a lot of doubts about teaching, about whether he should just practice and just that's all that was to it. He said that this Dharma that I have attained is profound and hard to see, hard to discover. It is the most peaceful and superior goal of all, not attainable by mere rationalization, subtle for the wise to experience. But this generation of people, relies on attachment, relishes attachment, delights in attachment. It is hard for such a generation to see this truth, that is to say, specific conditionality, dependent arising. It is hard to see this truth, that is to say, stilling of all formations, relinquishing of all the essentials of existence, exhaustion of craving, fading of lust, cessation, nibbana. And if I taught the Dhamma, others would not understand me, and that would be wearying and troublesome for me. Just reflecting on how hard it was to see, how deeply he had to release to see the truth, and reflecting that most people would not understand. And he really considered just not even going into this teaching direction he went. Luckily, a Brahmin sensed that and went to the Buddha. And he said that the world would be lost. The world would be utterly lost, for the mind of the perfect one, accomplished and fully enlightened, favors inaction and not teaching the Dharma. And he went to the Buddha and said, you know, Lord, let the blessed one teach the Dharma. Let the sublime one teach the Dhamma. There are beings with little dust on their eyes who are wasting not hearing the Dhamma. Some of them will attain final knowledge of the Dhamma. And that sense of little dust on our eyes. That's what practice is about, clearing that dust so we can see clearly, see directly how life really is. And so the Buddha responded, convinced, wide open are the portals of the deathless. Let those who hear show faith. If I was minded to not tell the sublime Dhamma I know, it was that I saw fixation in the telling. So he realized it was his own hesitation, but he was called forth to teach. And he went forth and taught for over 30 years. And looking at it, I think there's 3,000 suttas that he left. And so the depth and breadth of his teachings are profound. And both Tori and I have our basket of suttas on our shelves with, you know, hundreds and hundreds upon suttas. And there's such aliveness and richness in those. And we're very blessed to have a founding teacher who is able to teach and develop so deeply for so many years. So finally, when the Buddha, these are the last words he said before he passed away. Let me jump to that section. Yeah. So he died about age 80 after teaching for about 35 years. And his last words, indeed, bhikkhus, I declare this to you. It is the nature of all formations to dissolve, attain perfection through diligence. So his last words were to keep practicing, to see this for yourself. All right, so thank you for celebrating the life of the Buddha, and I'll turn you over to Tori.
Man, that was so beautiful. Sometimes, Tim, I could just listen to you give Dhamma talks forever. It was so beautiful. I'm so inspired now. I want to talk about Vesak itself, what it is. I mean, it's a ceremony that we're doing it here, but it's sort of like get in your mind that thousands and hundreds of thousands and millions of Buddhists are participating in a ceremony. I was a little late coming on this call because I participated in a ceremony at 6 a.m. this morning. And that it's just a ceremony that represents, that encompasses all of Dhamma together, everything that we practice. And it's held in May because I also wanted to share a little bit of details about our practice here around Buddhism, because we don't really, in this insight tradition, we don't always focus on the Buddhist, traditional Buddhist things about this practice. And there are some traditional Buddhist things. It would be like going to a Christian practice without understanding the nature of Christmas or Easter or what it means. Going into Islam practices, Muslim practices, and not understanding Ramadan, or even with Judaism, claiming that you are sharing in Judean practice, and yet you don't know anything about Passover or Hanukkah, all of these other holy days. And for Buddhists, there's Upasasa days, which is the full moon of each month. But the real holy day is Vesak, this day. And it's celebrated this day by millions of people doing exactly what we're doing. What it represents is that Buddha was born the day of his birth. There is the day that he became enlightened, and then there is the day that he died. And all three of those events, this is the tradition, happened in May on the full moon, which is why we're practicing. That's why it shifts at different times. It's whenever the full moon is in May. And it's said that the significance of that, so when we think about Christmas, we think about, oh, I'm celebrating the birth of Christ, or Easter, I'm celebrating the resurrection of Christ. But in Vesak, what we are celebrating is this triad of the Buddha being born, his awakening, and his death, all occurring on the exact same full moon in May. That's why it's this day and not just any other day. And the way that we celebrate it, the way that we take on this day, is different for people. Some people, ultimately, it's all about paying homage to the Buddha. And listening to Tim talk about his life in this way, you can see what it is that you're paying homage to. It's funny because before I actually started teaching, and I'm so happy that my graduation occurred in the month of Vesak, so that ending the teacher training in the month of Vesak all occurred at the same time. It just feels like it's very special but poignant. because when I'm in practice mode and I am going on retreat and I have teachers and Philip Moffitt is my teacher, Rodney's my teacher, so I have these relationships with teachers the same way people have relationships with me. And I didn't realize what it meant to pay homage to a teacher until I became a teacher. And I realized that the real sort of gift, the greatest gift, the greatest honor, the greatest support you could ever give a teacher comes from one or two ways. The first is this material way. Material, it's material in that you, your actions of generosity, kindness, care, basically living out the paramis, living out the perfections of truthfulness and determination, metta, all of it, equanimity, all of our acts are generating kindness and care for all beings everywhere. That act of learning how to be in the world where you are not to be feared by anyone, that is a gift that we give to our teachers. Every day that I support other people and do right by people, do right by my life, do right by society as a whole, it might seem a little weird for a culture that's based in individualism. But in the culture that Buddha was raised in, this Asian culture was much more collective, communal. So you didn't just live for yourself, you lived for the community as a whole. And every day that your life is offered as a gift to the community, as a contribution to the community, and not taking from the community, was a gift that you gave to your teacher. I didn't feel that as bluntly as I feel it now. So whenever I see, I understand now why Rodney would say that if we did not come together to create some event, it wouldn't happen. It just didn't happen. So if we did not volunteer to put out the chairs at Blodell Hall, or if we didn't volunteer to host all the things that were important for a non-residential, we wouldn't have the non-residential. We wouldn't meet at Blodell Hall. And I understand more now why he would say that. Because I think it goes to what the Buddha was trying to point to, that forcing and intimidating and kind of trying to beat mind with mind doesn't work. We try it all the time, and I'm a parent, so I've tried guilting my kids into doing what I wanted them to do, bribing, all kinds of little things, a little try to get them to do what I want. And when they were younger, it was easy to, you know, a little bribe here, a little guilt there, a little force here, a little push here. But when they get older and they become into their own, if my habit of getting them to do what I want comes out of bribing and forcing, intimidating and pushing and shoving, when they get older, that turns into a brittle fight with them. And it's less care and more suffering. When they're young, it's easy. They don't know. But when they get older, it becomes a pushback. And we begin to have tension and tightness. So if you raise your kids, you got to have a little bit of guilt there, a little bit of, you know, bribing going on, persuading. but that the basic root of your relationship is love and kindness, then even if you have some tensions when you get older, the relationship itself is held together by that love and that kindness. And that's what I begin to realize, that teachers inspire and cultivate love. That's what Buddha did. He inspired people to take up this mantle of love and compassion. And I think of Joseph and Sharon and Jack, and what they did was they came into a culture that is all very, very, very subjective, and they taught Dhamma, communal, come together, I mean, a culture that's very individualistic, and they brought this community of Sangha. They brought together the idea of love. I mean, Sharon brought loving kindness in a world that's very, like, scared and we don't even like to say the word love, let alone loving kindness, and I'm going to cultivate a practice. And she really brought the idea and the functionality of being, of practicing with loving kindness into the world. This idea of being, it's not like they brought it to, I don't want to mistake this. I'm not saying that Jack or Sharon or Joseph brought Buddhism to America, because sometimes that can get a little twisted. Buddhism was way here, way longer than they were. What they brought is, I would say, to the average white, black, non-Buddhist, this Judeo-Christian world, they brought that element of Buddhism and this expansiveness. So they brought the material side. And when we practice and when we cultivate kindness and our expression in that way, that's what we're doing. We're giving homage to our teachers and their teachers and their teachers all the way back to the Buddha, to what the Buddha's original understanding was. The second way that we pay homage to a teacher and to Dhamma itself is through practice. So this day is spent as a day of practice for many, 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 many beings. So some people will practice the entire day. They start with like the 6 a.m. ceremony I was at. It starts at 6 a.m. and they practice like a what we would call a day of mindfulness all the way up into the evening. Some people take ordination vows and they practice as a monastic that whole day. So they have their whole head shaved off and they take on robes, and it's just for one day, but they go through the whole ceremonial aspect of it. Some people don't. Some people, they go to the temple, they do a ceremony like this on their way to go into work. It's just the same as we are here. But practice is the other way in which we give homage to a teacher, Buddha being our teacher. It is this taking the actual practices that he noted and putting them into play. So practicing with, it's sort of like Tim was saying, with a yogi that's struggling, trying to sit on the floor in full lotus, and then encouraging them to move into a chair. And that taking on that practice and actually moving into the chair and continuing the practice, you cultivate this more ease and deep concentration in relationship to it. That act of practicing, I can see now, understand now why Rodney would get so edgy if you're not really practicing. Because that was what he wanted to present to people, was practice. That's what Philip That's why Philip, like, goes, he works way too much, but that's why he puts all that energy in, is because of his wanting to support people in their practice. And I know Tim and I have that same kind of wanting to support in practice. So what this day is about is spending the day either paying homage to the Buddha for all that he did, that Tim so beautifully explained, by doing good works, being kind, paying attention to being careful, and practicing. Maybe traditional practice that we're going to share some of the practices you can do, or just practicing, 5 minutes before the hour each day, each hour as the day passes. However we practice, that idea is that either practice and or our acts of goodwill and kindness, patience, peacefulness, all of this is how we pay homage to the Buddha this day for everything that he did in order for us to awaken also. So there are things that come together. I just want to close that though. So thank you so much for... There's some things that come together in practice. Ceremony to me is one of them. Ritual, ceremony. I believe we need ceremony to feel the softness of what we're doing. And it to take it out of the ordinary and put it into something else. So some things, I don't know if you guys brought it with you, but I was asking you to bring a bowl and a Buddha, some water, some flowers, and a candle. You don't have to. Tim, if you'll write that in the chat, you can send it. This is something that you can do on your own. Anytime. It doesn't have to be connected to VSAC, but VSAC is how we connect all this together. So what all these things represent is the bowl is the container. It's like your practice. It's the container that we keep our life in. We hold our lives in the Dhamma. We don't apply the Dhamma to our lives. We actually, the Dhamma is the container. This is the container of our lives. That's what we're doing. So within this bowl, you put the Buddha, if you have one. And actually, a teacher told me that if you don't have an actual statue, you can put... a picture. And yes, the water is going to mess up the picture. Okay, that's what's going to happen. But you put the picture of the Buddha in there. You don't have to have the statue because it doesn't get messed up. It doesn't matter. We can always print out another picture and put that in there. So I would suggest don't use your favorite Buddha picture. If you use your favorite Buddha picture, you might want to put it on the outside of the bowl so it doesn't get ruined. And then in this bowl, we're going to put some water. We're going to put some water because water is also a conduit. It moves. It's not stationary. It, even ice, you can think of ice as being stationary, solid, not to be moved. But we are realizing that even ice, even the ice formations that we have, now the word is escaping me, is beginning, all the glaciers are beginning to melt. that there's a reality that ice, water moves. And so the nature of our existence is this movement. It's held together, actually, by that movement. Water is also a conduit. It holds, like the bowl, it holds energy. I don't know how water does this, but it seems to be alive to me, and it holds energy. So if I have a lot of heavy energy in the house, I'll just sit a bowl of water and say a prayer over it, and before long, that energy will dissipate out of the house, because I think it's drawn in by the water. I think water holds energy. And so into that water, we want to infuse a sense of our loving kindness, our care. That's what the chanting is going to do. And then when that water evaporates, that energy that it's infused with just disseminates all over the house. And then the other thing that we want is a candle. And I think, I don't know if you got a candle, this candle, but if you don't, you can think about getting one today, is to get a candle that really, really smells nice. Because we want, it's like our sensory experience of any given moment is what precedes us. I better hurry along, hadn't I, Tim? Because our ceremony is supposed to be ending in just a few minutes. All right. And then the last thing is flowers. And actually, you just want to take some of the flowers. Take some of these flowers and put them into this water. And it's sort of to remind us both of beauty, but also of the, it's like, like Tim said in his talk that when Mara would throw all of this negativity towards the Buddha, it would just land on him like flowers. And so, we take these flowers and we just put it into the water. You don't have to put them all in there. You could also just keep the flowers around. All right, so we have the little ceremony set up here, and I want to do this metta chant for us. I'm going to share my computer here. Here we go. I am doing the advanced computer sound. All right. So I don't want you to have to read the words. It's the chant in Pali. So I'm going to say the words as the chant's playing. But I would like you to take a moment to just be here. Think about the people who, you know, just the many ways in which people support us. Teachers, friends, family, parents. We're very, very supportive as beings. It doesn't seem that way because our lives are difficult and we can get caught in the difficulty. But I'd like us just to take a moment to think about how our lives are being supportive so that you can listen to the Pali and I'll translate the English for you. Oh, I be free from enmity and danger. May I be free from mental suffering. May I be free from physical suffering. May I take care of myself happily. May my parents, teachers, relatives and friends, and my fellow Dharma farers, may they be free from enmity and danger, be free from mental suffering, be free from physical suffering, and may they take care of themselves happily. May all yogis connected to self be free from enmity and danger. And may they be free from mental suffering. May they be free from physical suffering. And may they take care of themselves happily. May all the teachers associated with self, and any monks, novice monks, laymen and laywomen, practitioners, may we be free from enmity and danger, be free from mental suffering, be free from physical suffering, and may we take care of ourselves happily. May all those who give dana to all of our support be free from enmity and danger, be free from mental suffering, be free from physical suffering, and may they take care of themselves happily. May our guardians and devas within the sims, within our individual homes, and within the university friends meeting hall, may all guardians and devas be free from enmity and danger, be free from mental suffering, be free from physical suffering, and may they take care of themselves happily. May all beings, all breathing things, all creatures, all individuals, all personalities of any type, may all females, all males, all noble ones, all worldlings, all deities, all humans, all those in the four woeful planes, be free from enmity and danger. Be free from mental suffering. Be free from physical suffering. And may they take care of themselves happily. May all beings be free from suffering. May whatever they have gained not be lost. All beings are the owners of their karma in the eastern direction, in the western direction, in the northern direction, in the southern direction, in the southeast direction, in the west direction, in the northeast direction, in the southwest direction, in the direction below, in the direction above. So leave your water, leave your flowers. If you didn't make it yet, you can put it together anytime you want today. Tim's going to share some practices with us. Leave your candle, one that's smelling. Let it burn all day. Let the water just disappear on its own. And let it remind you that we're paying homage to our teacher. We're paying homage to our practice. Okay, Tim.
Thank you, Chwery, for that lovely ceremony. Yeah, that was wonderful. All right, so I just want to offer a few practices that you may take up today. You know, as Chwery said, that traditionally this is a day of practice, and some of you may have the space and luxury to make the whole day of practice, and some of us have, you know, things we have to, responsibilities, things we have to do. So I'm going to offer a few things, and I put actually in the chat is a link to a Google document. Hopefully most of you can access that. And that has self-explanatory. There's also a link to that that document that I talked about, the article about the Buddha's life. So you're welcome to enjoy that. And it's also coming out at the newsletter, which is about 9 o'clock this morning. So if you haven't subscribed, you're welcome to do that. So if you have limited time during the day, I would suggest you practice twice today. I mean, it might be only 5 minutes, might be 30, 60 minutes, whatever seems to be appropriate. Pick one of the precepts and one hindrance to really focus on today as you engage with your life. And there's the list of those hindrances, both and the precepts, both the kind of the refraining from killing and harming, and then also the non-harm aspect of that. So just see which one kind of stands out to you. Maybe one that you struggle with, maybe one that you really appreciate. And the same too with the hindrances, which ones seem to be, really resonate for you. Make it simple and just notice how, as you go through your day, how those come up and how you can choose to bring more attention to them. And once an hour, maybe on the hour, pause for 30 seconds or a few minutes, reflect on the Buddha, you know, just pause in meditation. You may even consider chanting homage and refuges, which I've included down in that list. And then for people with more time, these ones Chwery developed, First decide how long you want to practice, maybe an hour, half a day, or all day, or something in between. Second, formally take on the refuges and precepts for your period of practice. This creates that container that's so essential. I'm thinking about those people who might ordain just for the day. It could be a sense of ordaining for that day in your own life. And then third, create a schedule of alternating sitting and walking, 30 minutes each or 20 minutes sit, 10 minutes walk. You can create what seems to work and then use that container to help you stay within your little day of practice. And then she also wrote a reflection that keep your focus on the present moment. Whatever arises is to be practiced with. It is to be felt and understood. Do not be swayed by the desire to quit. Take note of the hindrances of desire, aversion, restlessness, sloth, torpor, or doubt. Remind yourself often that you're simply cultivating the continuity of a mindfulness. And remember to connect to gratitude for being able to spend this time practicing. You're practicing with hundreds of thousands of yogis over the world. And at the end of the day, end of your practice period, listen to a Dharma talk. And Tweri pulled a couple from Dharma Seed as a suggestion. And there is both the description, and I put the link down there also. If you have trouble, you can just search the title, and that will pop up for you. So I hope you engaged, whatever level that makes sense to you. You can pick and choose between those practices, and we'll be practicing along with you. And as everyone at Sims and the call today, we'll practice together. So I appreciate us spending this time together and really celebrating this beautiful being who awoke and has shared his teachings that we still resonate with some 2,600 years later. So thank you so much.
Well, that concludes our VSEC ceremony for today. Thank you so much for being here. If you'd like to unmute yourself and say goodbye or put something in the chat, we appreciate it. Just know you're in good company this morning. Millions, that's what you have to get. Millions of people are doing the exact same thing we're doing right here. Thank you so much.